Some of you, on behalf of my friends and colleagues at Pepper Hamilton, some of whom I'm glad to say are with us today. There is a nice tradition of Pepper Hamilton and the Middle East Forum going back some years, and we always like to have the opportunity to host meetings of the forum. And it's a real pleasure today. We have a good program for you. And it is my brief role, which I will now have completed by introducing Bob Guzzardi, who will introduce our speaker.
First, let me thank Murray for allowing us to use the office today, but in the past. And Murray's not only one of the people that generous with the office space, but he actually comes and listens, which is a big plus to the speakers. My name is Bob Guzzardi. I'm on the Board of Governors of the Middle East Forum, and thanks to everybody for coming and participating in this event. I'm pleased to introduce Gary Gamble. If you don't mind, we are recording this, and we'd like to ask you to make sure that your cell phones are off, which I will double check and see that mine is off. Yes. And this event is being recorded, so at the time of questions, I just want you to all be aware of that. At the end of the program, we'll take questions that probably Gary will conduct the question and answering session. Gary is one of the leading American specialists of the Syrian-Lebanon nexus, and he is the editor of the Middle East Intelligence Bulletin, which is found on the website of the Middle East Forum, and is published, it's an Internet monthly co-published by the Middle East Forum. He has closely examined key aspects of the occupation of Lebanon by the Syrians and other issues that have otherwise been neglected. He talks about arbitrary disappearances, Syrian settlers in Lebanon, Hezbollah's relationship with Damascus, and the orchestration of Lebanese elections. He has an MA in Arab Studies from Georgetown University and is working on his PhD dissertation at New York University. And despite the venue of Georgetown University, he is very much to, I think, our way of thinking. And this is the latest event, the latest publication on the Sheer Bashar Assad, and I think it's one very interesting. Barry?
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to speak to you today about this topic. Lebanon is a subject that's both dear to my heart and my intellect. The Syrian occupation of Lebanon is particularly relevant today for a number of reasons, but I'd just like to briefly mention them. First, the Bush administration has openly committed itself to advancing democratization in the Middle East. You know, the Middle East, compared to other regions of the world, has stagnated politically in the last 30 years. And the Bush administration has set democratization as being in the American national interest. Lebanon is the only state in the Arab world that has a democratic tradition. For the first 30 years of its since its independence, it had a functioning democratic system. It is also, insofar as Iraq could serve as an example to spread democracy elsewhere in the Arab world, Lebanon is naturally the next step. It is the only other Arab state in which Shiite Muslims constitute the largest ethnic group. It is also multi-sectarian, much like Iraq, so there are a lot of similarities. In fact, most Shiite clerics in Lebanon were trained in Najaf, the holy city in Iraq. The second factor that makes the Syrian occupation of Lebanon particularly relevant has to do with the peace process. Since September 2000, during the Palestinian intifada against Israel, it's become more apparent than ever that Lebanon is central to Palestinian violence against Israel. And what I mean by that is that Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command, all of these groups have training camps in Lebanon that are operated under the authorization of Syrian troops in the Bekaa Valley. So Lebanon is very much central to the Arab-Israeli conflict. It is central to the ability of the Palestinians and the ability of the Syrians to play the terrorism card. And frankly, getting the Syrians to stop sponsoring terrorism isn't as easy as just getting them to close offices in Damascus, although that's what's been in the news recently. The thing about Lebanon is that the Syrians can always deny that they have knowledge of you know, for example, when a couple of years ago, when the Israelis intercepted a boat that had come from northern Lebanon laden with arms to the Palestinians, you know, the Syrians could say, well, we didn't know anything about that. So as long as Syria is in Lebanon, there's this fuzziness as far as who's accountable for what. Finally, the Syrian occupation of Lebanon is relevant today because U.S. policy towards Syria appears to be in flux. On March 12th of this year, Colin Powell used the word occupation to describe the presence of Syrian troops in Lebanon. The first time that this word has been uttered with regard to the Syrian presence in Lebanon in at least a decade. So, a year ago, the Syrian occupation of Lebanon was sort of a footnote to the news that we had about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or the Iraq conflict. Now I think it is very much central and important to understand. I'm going to begin by giving a brief background of Lebanese history, just the basics that, you know, that we need to know to discuss this. Then I'd like to discuss what Syria gets out of the occupation of Lebanon, which is very important to understand because it's one of the few occupations in history that is enormously lucrative. It is not something that ideological commitment necessarily drives. It is something that's very profitable. And I'd like to discuss why the international community has tacitly accepted Syrian hegemony in Lebanon. And then finally, I'd like to discuss what impacts Lebanese resistance to the Syrians. Over the last 1,500 years or so, the rugged terrain and proximity to Europe of Lebanon has led it to become a refuge for minorities in the Middle East, mainly Christian minorities such as the Maronite Catholics, Greek Orthodox, Armenian Christians, heterodox Islamic sects like the Shiites, the Druze, even small numbers of Alawites. So because of that, over the last few hundred years, under the Ottoman Empire, Lebanon was sort of set apart. It had its own administration and a form of power sharing evolved under the Ottomans and continued and was institutionalized under the French during the French Mandate. And the main minorities, very briefly, as of 1932, which was when the last official census was taken, and these are in order of the size, are Maronite Christians, Sunni Muslims, Shiite Muslims, Greek Orthodox, Druze, Armenian Christians, and then there are about 10 other small communities. In fact, there used to be a small Jewish community in Beirut. When Lebanon gained independence, the Lebanese constitution mandated that power would be shared among the minorities, that, for example, the number of seats in parliament would be set at a fixed 6-to-5 ratio of Christian to Muslim seats. And an unwritten agreement called the National Pact was reached, whereby the president would always be a Christian, the prime minister would always be a Sunni, the speaker of parliament would always be a Shiite Muslim, and various administrative posts, you know, such as the commander of the army would always be a Christian, the minister of defense would traditionally be a Druze. So this power-sharing system went from the very top levels of government all the way down to the bureaucracy. For the first 30 years of Lebanese history, as I mentioned, it was a functioning democratic system. Ironically, one of the factors that helped preserve democracy in Lebanon for 30 years also hastened its demise. Unlike other Arab states, Lebanon had a very low level of military spending. And this is actually related in part to its pluralism. There's a joke about the 1948 war in which a Lebanese commander comes to the front, you know, the border with Israel, and sees four Maronite Christians and two Druze soldiers sitting around with their guns, and, you know, they haven't marched into Israel yet. And he said, "Well, what's the matter?" And they replied, "Well, we're waiting for three Sunnis, two Shiites, and a Greek Orthodox." So, in a sense, you know, these communal identities, the power sharing in these communal identities, help preserve the democratic system. But it only worked as long as within each community, the traditional leadership held sway. That way, traditional leaders, you know, like traditional Shiite political elites and Maronites and Sunnis, could make compromises and then sort of enforce the compromises they made. What began to happen, because of demographic and socioeconomic changes, Shiites became a majority of the population. I'm sorry, not a majority of the population, but they surpassed the Maronites as the largest group in Lebanon. And of course, because of that, they wanted changes in the system, you know, that would lessen Maronite supremacy. Socioeconomic changes led to elites in all the communities being discredited to some extent. So the system would have broken down in the 70s anyway. But what led to the 15-year Lebanese civil war was very much external intervention. And at first, it was the Palestinians. As many of you probably know, in 1970, King Hussein fought the PLO in Jordan and expelled most of the armed Palestinians in Jordan. Most of those went into Lebanon, where there had already been a presence. But between 1970 and 1975, the PLO developed this state within a state in Lebanon and began to destabilize the country because Lebanese Muslims, who were demanding a greater piece of the pie, aligned themselves with the armed Palestinians. That led the Maronites to start forming armed militias. And so in 1975-76, a civil war broke out that was more or less Lebanese, apart from the Palestinian element. Okay, enter Syria. In 1976, the Palestinian Muslim faction was on the verge of defeating the Christian militias, and this is something that neither the Americans or the Israelis wanted to see happen. So in 1976, there was an unwritten agreement called the Red Line Agreement, under which Syrian troops entered Lebanon, reined in the Palestinian factions. And the agreement was that they would not send troops to the border in South Lebanon, they would not send troops into East Beirut, they would not use their air force in Lebanon. But the point is that the initial entry of Syrian troops in Lebanon was approved by the United States and Israel. You know, the Syrians did not do it the way Saddam Hussein did. They you know, basically got permission. Of course, within 2 years, the Syrians had turned on the Christians and were fighting the main Christian militias. In fact, over the next 14 years, just about everyone fought the Syrians. In the mid-80s, it was when the Syrians expanded their control into the northern part of Tripoli, they were fighting Sunni fundamentalists. In 87, when they took over the southern suburbs of Beirut, they were actually fighting Hezbollah for a while. The Syrian conquest of Lebanon was completed in 1990, again, with tacit American and Israeli approval. If you remember, Iraq invaded Kuwait in August 1990. In September 1990, James Baker visited Damascus and basically got Syrian agreement to join the Gulf War Coalition. The next month, Syrian troops stormed into East Beirut and defeated the last remnants of the First Lebanese Republic. So after October 1990, Lebanon is essentially a Syrian satellite state. Since then, Syrian control has become institutionalized. The the electoral process in Lebanon, which maintains some vestiges of democracy, is orchestrated by the Syrians to produce pro-Syrian candidates. For example, I mean, there are a lot of different ways in which it works, but it's interesting because it's very subtle. For example, districts in Lebanon, in eastern Lebanon, where the Syrian troop presence is the strongest, have a larger ratio of population, I'm sorry, a smaller ratio of population to deputies. So, like, they have more representatives than areas of Lebanon that don't have a strong Syrian troop presence. A variety of gerrymandering, election day shenanigans, legal aspects. For example, in Lebanon, there's no law that requires voters to close the curtain when they go into a voting booth to vote. And the reason is that if you're required to close the curtain, you can't sell your vote because no one at the poll can, like, see that you're voting the right way. So it's actually very, very ingenious because in some respects, you know, around election season, there is, you know, very vibrant campaigning. It's just that it's between candidates that have serious approval. So, okay, I'd like to... Okay, the next thing I'd like to discuss very briefly is what does Syria get out of the occupation of Lebanon? This is very important to understand because basically Lebanon is much, much more important to Syria than anything, than the Golan Heights, than anything having to do with the peace process. It is the number one, without question, the number one Syrian foreign policy goal is maintaining this occupation of Lebanon. And the reason, there are five major benefits Syria derives from the occupation. The most important, though, is economic. There are an estimated 1.2 million Syrian workers in Lebanon who do not pay taxes, they are not officially registered, they do not pay for worker permits, and they send the bulk of their wages back home. So it's estimated that up to $3.6 billion a year is siphoned off of the Lebanese economy just through Syrian workers alone. If you ever wonder why Syria is the only Arab country that still has essentially a statist socialist economic system, it's because it's basically feeding off Lebanon. It hasn't had to implement economic reforms. And of course, you know, this has a very pernicious impact on Lebanon. Although Lebanon has a very vibrant free market system, and the Lebanese people just seem to have a natural aptitude for economic affairs, you know, the national debt has skyrocketed. It's about 1.5 times the annual GNP, and this is largely because of Syrian influence. Second is trade. Once Syrian troops completed their occupation of Lebanon, all trade barriers were removed. So you have Lebanon, which has a GNP of about 3 times that of Syria, and prices, of course, being much higher. And Syria can basically dump any agricultural goods or manufactured goods it wants in Lebanon. And, of course, that also has economic benefits for Syria. And the flip side of it, you'll notice, you know, it's commonly said that, you know, the biggest opponents of the occupation are Christian. But in fact, if you were to take a poll, I guarantee you would find that Shiites are the most irate because they're the ones who are farmers who are basically left destitute just because of, you know, Syrian produce pouring into Lebanon. But, you know, the South Lebanon Farmers Association, it's in the news constantly complaining about Syrian, you know, the existing trade laws with Syria. Third, this is the third economic aspect. You cannot do business in Lebanon unless you have a Syrian partner. In virtually every sector of the economy, companies either openly or covertly have a Syrian partner. And I'll give you an example. Until recently, when the cell phone sector was reorganized, until recently, there were two cell phone companies in Lebanon, Cellus and Levancel, and both of them had a list of Lebanese investors. You know, like in Levancel, it was the son-in-law of Rafiq Hariri and then some of his brothers. But behind them, they were fronting for officials in the Syrian military intelligence apparatus. And, you know, the fact that cell phone calls in Lebanon, this is true about a year ago, cost 35 cents a minute rather than 8 cents a minute, which is the average. The reason why the government keeps rates so high is because the Syrians are pocketing money every time the Lebanese use their cell phones. And you find this scam repeated in every sector of the Lebanese economy. And of course, there are other illicit activities, not so much important now, but back in the 80s and 90s, they were very important. Smuggling, counterfeiting, drug running. The Syrians have basically milked Lebanon for all it's worth. And they are not going to give it up unless they absolutely have to. And in fact, you know, the conventional wisdom is that the Syrian presence in Lebanon stabilizes Lebanon or reduces instability. I would argue that it's the opposite, that the Syrian government is so dependent on this lifeline from Lebanon, this influx of billions of dollars a year, because it can't reform its own economy. It's so dependent on that that if Syria was forced to give up Lebanon, the Assad regime may very well fall. But it's not at all clear that it would be able to stand without this influx of funds. Second, very briefly, there are diplomatic benefits to controlling Lebanon. And one example I want to give is in February, when Syria was mobilizing other Arab states against U.S. efforts to build support for regime change in Iraq, there was an Arab League foreign ministers meeting in Cairo, and the rotating chair of the meeting happened to be Lebanon. Well, what the Lebanese did, and this is according to Kuwait's ambassador to the Arab League, the chair of the meeting, which is the Lebanese foreign minister, drafted a statement that condemned any assistance offered to the American war effort, and I'm quoting from the Kuwaiti foreign minister here, did not form a committee to write the final statement, distributed it minutes before the end of the meeting after having informed only one other delegation, Syria's, although he didn't say it, and ignored a request backed by 10 Arab states to put the statement to a vote. And so it was, a very irregular process. It was issued, and this was basically Syria pulling the strings for Lebanon to do it. Now, interestingly, Kuwait is the second largest donor to Lebanon of economic aid. And after this happened, the Kuwaiti parliament nearly passed a measure cutting aid to Lebanon. And, there were Kuwaiti parliament members just absolutely furious. So this is not at all an action that could conceivably be an expression of Lebanese interest. The Syrians basically gain all sorts of benefits from, for being able to have Lebanese diplomats pull this kind of stuff. Third, strategic benefits. The military advantages are very clear. Lebanon is a natural invasion route to and from Israel. More importantly than that, though, is, as I was alluding to earlier, all of these terrorist groups in Syria backs have training camps in Lebanon. They launch attacks from Lebanon. Lebanon allows Syria to have a certain amount of plausible deniability when it sponsors attacks. So Lebanon is an important strategic bargaining chip for Syria. Finally, there is ideological benefits. The Syrian regime is ostensibly Arab nationalist, and there is also a strong current of greater Syrian nationalism. The Syrian government does not have an embassy in Beirut. Until last year, no Syrian head of state had ever visited Lebanon officially. So there is, to some extent, the migration of Lebanon is consistent with the regime's ideology. What I would argue, though, is that if you just look at the economic benefits, any state neighboring Lebanon that could derive those kind of benefits from occupying it would occupy it if the world let it. So the most important thing to understand, which is what I'm going to get to now, is why the international community allows it. There is no official of any government in the world other than Israel that would use the word occupation to describe the Syrian presence in Lebanon. That is, except for Powell's, the exception he made in the heat of the U.S.-Syria crisis on March 12th. And he hasn't used the word since. So why is that? Well, American appeasement of Syria and its interest in Lebanon began in the 80s. If you remember at the time, Lebanon was basically terrorism central. It was the natural destination of any plane that would be hijacked anywhere in the Middle East. And of course, there was the whole issue of American hostages. There were, at one point, nearly 24 American hostages at different points in the 80s that were held. And basically, the Syrians said, you know, we'll free your hostages, but you have to let us expand our control of Lebanon. And that's essentially what happened. To some extent, this is also what has led Israel to accept, maybe not happily, but to accept Syrian control of Lebanon. For the Israelis, given a choice between signing a peace treaty with Syria, in which you have one signature that can guarantee you the Lebanon border will be quiet, just like the Golan Heights have been quiet for nearly 30 years, the idea that you can just have one man sign one piece of paper is very selective. With Lebanon, you know, admittedly, in the 70s, even before Syria moved into Lebanon, the government had trouble controlling Palestinian factions that were operating in its territory. So there's an argument to be made, and Israeli officials many Israeli officials have seen it this way, that, like it or not, the only way to have a quiet border in Lebanon is with some degree of Syrian influence. And in 1996, I believe, Peres actually said that any peace treaty with Syria would quote, take into consideration Syrian interests in Lebanon. Second, and this has more to do with the United States, the Syrian occupation of Lebanon, or American acceptance of it, has a lot to do with the peace process. The conventional wisdom at the State Department is that if we want to get Syria to come to the peace table, why bring up the issue of Lebanon? What we're going to do is get them to sign a peace treaty with Israel, and then later we'll pressure them on Lebanon. The problem with that, and actually, if you look at policy statements by U.S. officials, you'll see the statement all the time, we believe the withdrawal of all non-foreign forces from Lebanon should occur within the context of a comprehensive peace settlement in the Middle East. So that, you know, that is the official policy of the United States. The problem with that is there's no reason to believe that Syria would be any more disposed to withdraw from Lebanon after a peace treaty with Israel than it would before. Because, again, the economic benefits are the most important thing keeping it there. And if self-preservation is an instinct that the Syrian regime has, it will keep Lebanon because it is its economic lifeline. Finally, I would argue that there's a certain bureaucratic culture in the State Department and in other areas of the American government that believes that carrots are more effective in inducing changes in Syrian behavior than sticks. And I think this idea originated in the 1970s when large levels of American aid induced Sadat to make concessions to Israel and go to Jerusalem, and you had the Camp David Accords. In fact, at the same time, a lot of people know this, in the 1970s, hundreds of millions of dollars were given to Syria in economic aid. Only, of course, it didn't work. And so this idea of constructive engagement, the idea that the capacity of the United States to reward good behavior is greater than its ability to punish bad behavior is still enshrined. And part of it has to do with certain assumptions about Arab political culture, that there's issues of pride and shame, and that publicly, publicly calling them to task is not something that is effective. Okay, one of the most important, what I would say is that based upon, actually let me add one brief thing. One of the things we commonly hear about American appeasement with Syria is that it has a lot to do with American relations with the Arab world. Like, we don't want to put sanctions on Syria because the Egyptians maybe, or the Jordanians or the other Arab states, would find that objectionable. In fact, when American appeasement with Syria began in the mid 1980s, Syria was very isolated. The Jordanians hated the Syrians because they were sponsoring terrorism in the streets of Amman when King Hussein tried to inch closer to an agreement with Israel. The Egyptians were irate with the Syrians because Syria led the campaign to isolate Egypt after it signed the Camp David Accords. Syria sided with Iran in the Iran-Iraq War, so the Gulf states were upset with Syria. And of course the Palestinians, this is true several years ago, there are more Palestinians in Syrian jails than there are Israeli jails. So basically no one really liked the Syrians in the 1980s. So American peace with Syria really doesn't have anything to do with preserving good relations with the Arab world. In fact, it's also true that the Europeans in the 1980s weren't happy with the Syrians. Britain severed relations with Syria in 1986 after the Syrians sponsored a hijacking at Heathrow Airport. As late as 1990, France was trying to get the Security Council to condemn Syria's invasion of East Beirut. So this is something that very much that America led and the world followed. One last thing I want to discuss, I'm sorry I'm going over my time limit, is that this permissive international environment it is important doubly because it has an impact on events in Lebanon. And the reason this is important is that I would argue that external pressure alone is not going to get Syria to leave Lebanon. Again, it's really an issue of self-preservation for Lebanon. External pressure is only going to get Syria to leave Lebanon if it causes pressure within Lebanon to build as well. Now, there is a pattern that we see where when the outside world is critical of Syrian human rights abuses in Lebanon, there is more resistance in Lebanon. The best example I can think of is after the March 2000 summit in Geneva between Hafez Saab, this is a few months before he died, and Bill Clinton. After the summit, in which Hafez Saab essentially said, we're not going to budge an inch, there was, for a brief period of time, a very different American position on Syria. American officials were talking about the Syrian presence in Lebanon by name. They weren't using occupation, but they were publicly criticizing it. And so the Geneva summit had a huge impact in Lebanon. Within days, the head of Lebanon's leading newspaper wrote an editorial calling for Syrian troops to leave. This is the first ever in 10 years that the head of a newspaper, or anyone, has written in a newspaper, Syria should leave. And this was followed by an avalanche of other editorials. It was followed by a proliferation of protest marches. So when the Lebanese sense that the world is going to continue appeasing Syria, their attitude is, why should we stick our necks out? In 1989, 1990, when Michel Aoun launched his war of liberation against Syrian forces in Lebanon, the world looked the other way, and a lot of Lebanese died. So the Lebanese attitude is, if we ever feel that the world is not even going to come in and help us, but at least raise the alarm if the Syrians start killing us, then we'll resist. In fact, when Aoun was fighting the Syrians in 89, an assistant American Secretary of State testify before Congress that a string withdrawal from Lebanon might destabilize the country. That's how unresponsive the international community is. So I do believe that external pressure can generate a response in Lebanon. Lebanon has a vibrant independent press, has a vibrant civil society, and a lot of the ethnic tensions and disagreements that once upon a time created instability in Lebanon, I think, have very much subsided. So, you know, in the event that the United States began publicly calling a spade, I mean, you know, we're not even talking about proactive measures so much as we're talking about simply treating the Syrian occupation of Lebanon the way we would treat any other occupation of one state by another. I mean, this is very much an anachronism, the idea that Lebanon is a satellite state of Syria. I think I'll leave it there and let's go to the questions. Any questions?
Throughout the first question, something that you didn't mention that I believe probably interests mostly everyone in the room is the relationship of Hezbollah to Syria and Lebanon. Just a little bit about that, if you could.
Right.
Like, where do they fit in with this whole picture?
Right. Well, Hezbollah is very much a proxy of Syria in the sense that it would not be able to operate at all in Lebanon without Syrian authorization. In fact, before Israel pulled out in May 2000, one might be able to make the case that there was a certain degree of popular support for Hezbollah insofar as Israelis were occupying Lebanese land. You know, they could use the propaganda to portray that as a national liberation issue. Since the Israeli withdrawal, we have seen Shiite political leaders who are not affiliated with Hezbollah come out and be openly critical of continuing Hezbollah operations against Israel. In fact, Prime Minister Hariri himself, in March 2001, he owns a newspaper in Lebanon called Al Mustaqbal, and it published a front page editorial questioning Hezbollah's continuation of the war against Israel. That actually led Bashar Assad to cancel a visit by Hariri to Damascus and invite one of his political competitors instead. So one, there really is not firm support within Lebanon for Hezbollah. In fact, the Shiites in Lebanon pay the largest price for Hezbollah activities because no one is going to invest in South Lebanon as long as there's tensions there. So the fact that Hezbollah is still an issue is very much reflects the political calculus of Syria, I think, not Lebanese Shiites.
In the view of the greater Syria, what would you say is the current level of that Syrian nation to integrate Lebanon into Syria on a permanent basis?
That's a very good question. There have been a number of treaties that have been signed by Lebanon and Syria since Syrian troops moved into, since they completed their conquest in 1990. The first, in 1991, a treaty of brotherhood and cooperation essentially legalized the Syrian occupation. It said that Syrian troops will withdraw at some point in the future when the Lebanese and Syrian governments decide that it's time for them to withdraw. Of course, Syria controls Lebanese government. A few years later, there was an agreement, another security agreement signed, that in which both sides agreed not to let their media criticize the other. Like they said, we ban all political and media activity harmful to the other states. So Lebanon is one of the few states in the world that prohibits its own media from criticizing another foreign country. As I mentioned, trade has been, trade barriers have been removed. visa barriers too. You only need one visa to go to Lebanon or Syria. There has not been much talk openly of actual political union or annexation, but you know, Syria very much prefers it that way. For example, Syria has no interest in Syrianizing the Lebanese economy. The last thing it wants is for its cash cow to, like, turn socialist or turn communist, because then it would be as morbid as its own economy. So you know, ironically, Syria sort of benefits from a quasi-independent Lebanon, but it very much would not like to reduce its de facto control of Lebanon. And its de facto control of Lebanon, I think, is as secure as ever. There have been a few redeployments of Syrian troops recently, and the total number of troops has been reduced from about 40,000 to something like 22,000-23,000. Syrian troops are less visible. You know, there's not as much brute force that is used to control the population now. Syrian control of Lebanon has become more and more institutionalized. And that's the way the Syrians like it.
Mm-hmm. Could you give us a sense of the relative size of the population? Syria, something like 20 million, Lebanon, maybe something like 4 million. And would you also comment on the Israeli military activity in 1982 and bring that forward? What is the length of that operation, if any, on today's political
set? Mm-hmm. To answer your first question, Syria's population is about, I think, 18 million. Lebanon's is about 3.5. And interestingly, if you count the Syrian workers in Lebanon, there are more Syrians aged 18 to 25 in Lebanon than there are Lebanese. So, and you know, like, you know, you never hear the media use the term settlers to describe, you know, these Syrian workers, but they are Syrians who live and work in Lebanon. And in 1994, there was a naturalization decree that was shoved down the throats of the Lebanese that gave Lebanese citizenship to, I think it was like 100,000 Syrians and 200,000 Palestinians. So, you know, there is essentially an attempt by Syria to settle Lebanon. As for the 1982 invasion, do you mean its impact today in Lebanon?
Yeah. If anything,
well,
still, mm-hmm. I should see a little bit of a chance. Is it still something of a political currency there? People still talking about it? Is it still coloring the outlook of Lebanese, even if Syria were to completely disappear from the scene, would there be any rapprochement between Israel and Lebanon?
I think that there's not any, I think, natural hostility between the Lebanese and Israel. And, you know, of course, it's. You know, most of us remember, well, actually, I don't remember, but I've read, because I'm not old enough to remember. But in 1982, when Israel moved in, they were greeted with flowers and rice by the Shiites. And, you know, also when the Israelis occupied the Shuf Mountains in 83-84, the Druze cooperated with them. Of course, you know, the Christians don't have any natural beef with Israel. And the Sunni Muslims, insofar as, you know, the larger, you know, they have no more hostility towards Israel than the rest of, you know, the Sunni Arab world. So I think, I mean, Lebanon has very much been used by others as a launch pad to attack Israel. I mean, Lebanon, you know, there's really no Lebanese sect or ethnic group that has its own grievance. In fact, I mean, the only group that does is there's about close to 300,000 Palestinian refugees, of course, that are in Lebanon. And one of the issues there is that the Syrians haven't allowed the Lebanese government to control these camps. You know, so there's all sorts of trouble brewing there.
What do you think it will take to separate Lebanon from Syria and have it perhaps become reestablished as an independent state?
Well, as I said, I don't think external pressure alone is going to make the costs of occupying Lebanon greater than the benefits. However, if external pressure has, and I think it will, this synergistic effect on indigenous opposition to Syria and Lebanon, then, you know, for example, like before the September 11th attacks, which sort of made it more difficult for the Lebanese to openly resist the Syrians, and the reason for that was that American courting of Syria was so overt that it signaled to the Lebanese, okay, now's not the time to expect international help. Like in the summer of 2001, the Free National Current, which is Michelle Allen's group in Lebanon, they were organizing, they had like, you know, hundreds of students who would go out and sell vegetables and fruit in the streets of Beirut. Why? Because that's a job that Syrian workers typically do. And you know, they were like, we're going to do this for free just to deny the Syrians, you know, this cash flow. And Lebanon is a very sophisticated, educated, westernized society. So to the extent that America can encourage the Lebanese people themselves to undertake, you know, those kind of, I mean, we're not talking about picking up a gun and fighting the Syrians. We're talking about, you know, just civil disobedience alone, I think, would have a huge impact. And of course, also, if the United States starts using the word occupation to describe the presence, you know, the Syrian presence in Lebanon, starts being openly critical of it, and the Lebanese themselves start organizing more effectively, then I think it'll be very difficult for the Europeans to continue appeasing the Syrians. You know, I think just as the snowball of appeasing the Syria was set rolling, you know, frankly, by the United States in the 80s, I think the snowball, you know, a reverse snowball can be set in motion if the United States takes the lead.
How come you seem to hear so little about the Lebanese risk in the United States or other countries speak out where they can't be attacked by the Syrians? Why is there such a silence about the occupation?
Well, one, I think that there's not a silence. I mean, there are a lot of Lebanese activist groups in this country that have been lobbying for change in U.S. policy. In fact, you know, the new bill in Congress, the Syria Accountability and Lebanese Sovereignty Restoration Act, is actually a product of cooperation between Lebanese Americans and pro-Israeli groups to you know, put forward this kind of motion. So I think 3 or 4 years ago it was very true that there seemed to be a kind of apathy among Lebanese Americans. Today, over the last 3 or 4 years, I think there's been a lot of progress in you know, more effective action by Lebanese Americans.
The fact that the Lebanese government won't grant citizenship to any of the Palestinians, doesn't that create a tremendous amount of friction? They want them to go back.
That does create a problem. I mean, and it's true that the one thing that all Lebanese of every stripe and color believe adamantly is that the Palestinians should not be granted citizenship. For one thing, you know, there's been much more Christian emigration than Muslim emigration in Lebanon. So, you know, just for demographic reasons, the Christians, I think, have a pretty legitimate reason for fearing the naturalization of, I mean, I don't know what the percentage of the Palestinians in Lebanon who are Muslim are, but I imagine it's the same as it is outside. So it would affect the demographic balance in Lebanon. There have been proposals to resettle some of them in Iraq, you know, which actually seemed kooky until, you know, we liberated Iraq. I mean, that might be something. I think ultimately some of them are going to have to be naturalized in Lebanon. But I don't think it's possible to naturalize all of them without. I mean, just the fact that all Lebanese oppose it, I think there has to be a, you know, an outside solution. I mean, certainly, you know, adding 300,000 Palestinians to Iraq or to Jordan, well, maybe not Jordan, but to Iraq, wouldn't fundamentally rip apart the social fabric of the country.
Isn't that a source of income for the Lebanese government? because the United Nations supports the refugee camps.
I don't know specifically how much. I would say it's negligible. I don't think the Lebanese government has any role in the... I could be wrong. I'm not that familiar with the mission.
Mm-hmm. Bob Grant is making a presidential candidacy about the threat of Hezbollah much more than the administration. The threat of the United States. The threat of Israel. How big a threat is it? And if it is, what's the way Syria... I mean, would that problem better be addressed by Syria retaining control of Lebanon and asserting control of that situation or removing themselves?
Well, Hezbollah, as far as capabilities, is every bit as dangerous as Al-Qaeda. However, I'm not among those who see Hezbollah launching a jihad against the United States anytime soon. I mean, again, like the fact that Hezbollah has continued fighting Israel since the Israeli withdrawal is really a reflection of Syrian and Iranian interests, not Hezbollah. So whereas Al-Qaeda, you know, the dangerous thing about Al-Qaeda is that its goals and objectives were not really linked to any state. You know, like, you know, when you're a non-state actor, you can afford to be sort of crazy and have very, very extremist and unrealistic goals. Hezbollah, I think, is very much a reflection of the states that sponsor it. So, clearly taking... ending the Syrian occupation of Lebanon would essentially end Hezbollah because, you know, Iran supplies most of the weapons, but the planes land in Damascus International Airport and they're driven overland into Lebanon. So, you know, the whole issue of Hezbollah, it comes back to Syria, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Two questions. Number one, what's your assessment of Bashar al-Assad? And number two, if Iran supplies the weapons, and Damascus is the facilitator as a result of allowing the planes to land there and then transporting the weapons. I gather that we really would prefer that not happen. What would be the reason at this point in time without having all those very capable troops there and all those other armaments? Why wouldn't we just say essentially cut it out?
For regime change.
To answer your first question, everything that I've read about Bashar has been that he is basically a good guy. In fact, I haven't even heard any rumors about him being sadistic or mean or evil like his father. The problem is he's not fully in control. He's a figurehead. When his father died, Bashar did not have any official position in the government. I mean, his only title was head of the Syrian Computer Society. Right. And whereas there have been people like Defense Minister Mustafa Flass, who came to power when his father did in 1970 and had occupied senior positions in the military and in the government for three decades. And in those three decades, they developed these very extensive patronage networks to ensure the loyalty of the officer corps. And so Bashar just doesn't have anything like that. That's not to say that he doesn't wield some influence within the government, but no one really knows who exactly is calling the shots in the Syrian government. The one thing I can tell you is that it's not Bashar. I mean, when he first came to power, everyone is very optimistic because it's like, oh, he speaks English so fluently, he listens to Phil Collins, you know, Syria's, you know, going to take off and become westernized. And I think that was wishful thinking. To answer your second question, why don't we just tell the Syrians not to arm Hezbollah? I have to imagine that we have. The problem is that the United States has been very reluctant to impose punishments on the Syrians for actions that are unacceptable. Whether, I mean, not just Hezbollah, but sponsoring terrorism in general. In fact, Hezbollah, frankly, I find less repulsive than the fact that Hamas and Islamic Jihad have offices in Damascus. And their offices in Damascus, they send orders to cadres in the field, in Israel, to blow people up. I mean, you know, with Hezbollah, the relationship is a little more direct. In the case of these other groups, you know, with Hamas, you have an external leadership in Damascus that is much more radical than the internal leadership of Hamas, precisely because it's in Damascus. You have Syrian, a very strong Syrian impact on its strategy. And, you know, of course, these other groups rely exclusively on terrorism. You know, Hezbollah is sort of an equal opportunity group. It does terrorism, it does, you know, conventional military type of operation. So I think isolating Hezbollah is sort of misleading. The problem is Syria, and that problem manifests itself through Hezbollah, through Islamic Jihad, through, you know, Hamas. Through, I mean, there's a dozen groups that, you know, that Syria has some relationship with. I'm sorry.
Why don't we?
Well, because of some of the reasons I mentioned earlier. You know, American Middle East policy is very myopic or short-sighted. Every president, I don't care if he's a Democrat or Republican, wants a Nobel Peace Prize, wants to have that Rose Garden ceremony in which, you know, the Syrians sign a peace treaty with Israel, or the Palestinians sign a final status agreement with Israel. And it's there's this assumption that if you really crack down on the Syrians, that, you know, maybe 10 years from now, that'll pay off. You know, that Syria will go through a long period of time as a rogue state, maybe there'll be a change of regime down the road, but that's not going to pay off quickly. You know, the idea is, you know, there's a reigning assumption, I think, in Washington that sticks don't work with the Syrians, or at least not in the short term. And of course, you know, questioning Syrian control of Lebanon is not seen as something that's going to, you know, inch the Syrians closer to the peace table. Of course, I believe, you know, the idea that the Syrians will ever sign a peace treaty with Israel is questionable enough. So this mirage of Bashar Assad sitting down, you know, with the Israelis to sign a peace treaty, that itself, I think, is part of the problem.
Two questions. One is, what benefit is it to Syria to sponsor all this terrorism? What is their purpose? And second, you mentioned Kuwait being a donor state. Are you talking in foreign aid from Kuwait to Lebanon and then directly to Syria? What is their purpose, and why is that either necessary, and why do they do it?
That's a good question. Part of it is that all of the Gulf states have had close relations with Lebanon, partly because a lot of their expatriate labor force, especially in technical fields, is Lebanese. Lebanon has always been the playground of Gulf Arab sheikhs. Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, you know, the 11th richest man in the world, the Saudi prince, he's half Lebanese. His mother is Lebanese. I think part of it is just sort of good neighborliness. Part of it is also if you get Lebanon economic aid, you can get more of the pie as far as outside investment. But the Kuwait is with a lot of aid to a lot of Arab countries. They just tend to be very generous. What was the first question?
What is the point of the Syrian terrorism? Why did they sponsor Hezbollah? What are they? And I understand why the PA, Constantine Authority, doesn't think they want to destroy Israel. But what's Syria getting out of all of these sponsorships of all these different groups? Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, etc.
Well, several things. One, you could argue, I mean, this is the only means that the Syrians have pressure in Israel. Toward what end they're pressuring Israel is an open question, whether they want to go on, whether they want complete capitulation. But it's the only bargaining chip they have. Militarily, Syria obviously can't stand toe-to-toe with Israel. Of course, they have weapons of mass destruction. But second, just maintaining this crisis atmosphere, or maintaining this hostile relationship, and also this is why I think the idea that Syria just wants to go on hikes back and wants to have peace and live happily ever after is questionable. you know, as long as Syria is officially at war with Israel, as long as there's this hostile atmosphere, it can justify closing down newspapers in the name of national security. It can justify arresting journalists because, you know, they're a threat to national security. People are more reluctant to rise up and criticize the lack of democracy in Syria if they fear being accused of treason. So, to some extent, you know, the Syrian regime has become, and of course, you know, having a huge bloated military and security services and all that, which are ostensibly because of the situation with Israel, that's part of the way Syria controls its population. So in a lot of ways, Syria is sort of addicted to this kind of tense, hostile relationship with Israel, and the terrorist groups are the only way it has of, you know, of fighting.
One more question.
Mm-hmm.
All the various groups in Lebanon, I'm interested in Hamas here, and their relationship, and how they have maybe shifted towards, say, the Syrians and towards the protectors in Hezbollah. They seem to at times to oppose them, at times to cooperate with them, with Hezbollah.
Right. Once you've accepted that kind of patronage from the Syrians, to depart from it. In 1995, there was a member of parliament, Yahya Shammas, who was arrested and charged with drug smuggling in Lebanon. He was thrown in jail. And according to Shammas, what happened was he had bought a piece of land in Lebanon from the head of Syrian military intelligence. And unfortunately for Shammas, the land appreciated in value quite a bit. And the head of Syrian military intelligence wanted it back at the original price. And when he refused, you know, all the, and, you know, probably he was involved in some illicit stuff, you know, but since everybody's involved in that kind of stuff, you know, there's really no going back once you join the system.
Thanks, Gary.
I read the same thing. I know what you're talking about. I don't remember who wrote it.
He started off with nothing. He made his money.
I'm going to go to the next one.
know what?